and safer to handle. It would take years for such improvements to be made. Until then, the safety of America's nuclear weapons depended on checklists, standard operating procedures, and a laboratory culture with a low tolerance for mistakes. Bradbury worried about what would happen if a B-29 bomber crashed in the United States while carrying a fully assembled Mark III bomb. The B-29 had a high accident rate. Two had crashed and burned on the runways at Tinian while trying to take off the night before the bombing of Nagasaki. In 1947, the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project decided that the final assembly of Mark III bombs must always occur outside the United States. The reliability of the weapon's electronic, mechanical, and explosive components was unknown, and Bradbury thought that a crash during takeoff would pose a very serious potential hazard to a large area in the vicinity. The Mark III was considered too dangerous to be flown, fully assembled, over American soil, but no safety restrictions were imposed on flights of the bomb over Great Britain. Atomic bomb-making facilities were secretly constructed at two Royal Air Force bases, in Scunthorpe and Blakenheath. Before attacking the Soviets, American B-29s would leave the United States with partially assembled Mark IIIs and land at the British bases. Plutonium cores would be inserted into the weapons there, and then the B-29s would head for their Soviet targets. If one of the B-29s crashed during takeoff, the RAF base, as well as neighboring towns, might be obliterated. Anticipating that possibility, the U.S. Air Force explored sites in the countryside of Norfolk and Suffolk where atomic bombs could be hidden, so that if one blew, the others would survive. During the AFSWP's first attempt to assemble an atomic bomb, it took a team of 36 men 2 weeks to finish the job. That did not bode well for a quick retaliation against a Soviet attack. Through constant practice, the assembly time was reduced to about a day. But the Mark III bomb had a number of inherent shortcomings. It was a handmade, complicated, delicate thing with a brief shelf life. The electrical system was powered by a car battery, which had to be charged for 3 days before being put into the bomb. The battery could be recharged twice inside the Mark III, but had to be replaced within a week. And to change the battery, you had to take apart the whole weapon. The plutonium cores radiated so much heat that they'd melt the explosive lenses if left in a bomb for too long. And the polonium initiators inside the cores had to be replaced every few months. By the end of 1948, the United States had the necessary parts and cores to assemble 56 atomic bombs, enough for an atomic blitz. But the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project could deploy only one bomb assembly team overseas. It would take months for that team to put together so many atomic bombs, and a stray wire, some static electricity, or a little mistake could end the entire operation in a flash. Robert Purifoy was a senior at Texas A&M when a recruiter from Sandia visited the campus. America's nuclear weapons program was expanding, and it needed engineers. Purifoy was intrigued. Unlike his father, a prominent civil engineer who designed roads, buildings, dams, and other concrete structures, Purifoy was drawn to the study of electricity. Recent inventions like radar, television, the transistor, and the computer promised to transform American society. The typical A&M student with a degree in electrical engineering went to work for Dallas Power and Light or other utility companies after graduation. Designing nuclear weapons at a mysterious top-secret laboratory sounded a lot more interesting to Purifoy. And he was deeply patriotic. During the spring of 1952, the United States was at war. With the backing of Joseph Stalin and Mao Tse-tung, the communist regime of North Korea had invaded South Korea 2 years earlier, starting a conflict that eventually killed more than 2 million civilians. The threat of communist aggression was no longer hypothetical. Young American soldiers were once again fighting and dying overseas. When Sandia offered Purifoy a job, he eagerly accepted. It seemed like a good way to serve his country and satisfy his curiosity. Right after graduation, Purifoy and his wife Barbara packed up their belongings in College Station and moved to a small rental house in Albuquerque, not far from the lab. He was 21, ready to help the war effort, thrilled to be employed for $395 a month. But he was forced to work in Sandia's leper colony for the first 90 days, denied access to the classified areas at the lab. While the FBI conducted a background check, he spent 6 days a week recording weather information onto IBM computer cards with a pencil. It was not a thrilling job. In the fall of 1952, Purifoy obtained a Q clearance, allowing him access to top-secret material and Tech Area 1, the lab's research facilities. But his early work at Sandia didn't enable him to visit Tech Area 2, a separate group of buildings surrounded by guard towers and a perimeter fence. It was America's first atomic bomb factory. Tests conducted in the Marshall Islands a few years earlier had shown that composite cores made from a mix of plutonium and uranium would detonate, ending fears at the Pentagon about a potential shortage of fissile material. The United States would have more than enough for a large stockpile of atomic bombs. In 1949, full-scale production of a new implosion bomb had begun at Sandia, the Mark IV. It had a composite core. It could be assembled in a couple of hours, then stored for a couple of weeks. And it was much safer than previous designs. According to the final evaluation report, the Mark IV had a variety of features to prevent premature detonation under all predictable circumstances. The X unit didn't charge until the bomb fell from the plane, greatly reducing the risk to the aircrew. More important, the nuclear core was stored in the plane's cockpit during takeoff and inserted through a trap door into the nose of the bomb mid-flight. As long as the core was kept physically separate from the rest of the bomb, it was impossible for a plane crash to cause a nuclear explosion. The days of handmade nuclear weapons were over. At Sandia, the Mark IV was now being manufactured with standardized interchangeable parts. And so was its replacement, the Mark VI, a lighter, sleeker weapon with a yield as much as 10 times